Okay, so here's what happened. I podcasted about Lawrence of Arabia for the last Paleo Cinema podcast. And the day after I finished the podcast, Peter O'Toole died. A few podcasts ago, I also podcasted about Letter from an Unknown Woman starring Joan Fontaine. The day after Peter O'Toole died, Joan Fontaine died. So I've got this sense that maybe Paleo Cinema podcast is either foreshadowing the deaths of actors or causing them in some metaphysical and unknown way, kind of the way a butterfly's wing will cause a hurricane somewhere else on the planet. Not really going to happen, but I'm being a bit careful this time, and I'm going to do movies starring people who are dead. Just for this podcast, on the simple basis that you can't kill a dead person, except in a zombie movie. So, sit back, relax, and enjoy the last Paleo Cinema podcast for 2013. Paleo Cinema Podcast is a podcast about classic movies. There are only two rules. The movies have to be more than 20 years old at the time of recording, and they have to be movies that I recommend. Feedback is very important, and there are several ways to send it. You can email me at cultguru@gmail.com, that's cult with a K. You can leave a message at the paleocinema.blogspot.com website, that's Paleo Cinema with a dash. You can visit the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook, or you can even send a Twitter message at Paleo Cinema with no dash. There's also a voicemail line which has changed numbers again, so grab a pen. The new number is 206-337-5398. This podcast may contain adult concepts and language, profane and transgressive, so you know it's good. Okay, so how is everybody? Things here are going fine. We survived the festive season more or less intact. The weather is unusually mild for this time in the summer, but it's not a bad time to be out on my bicycle going around the place, which indeed is what I've been doing. Getting a little bit of exercise, working off the turkey and the pork from Christmas, or Newton Mass in my case, and in general enjoying the long, warm, balmy days. I scored an inordinate amount of Blu-rays for the holidays. A bunch of Criterion editions, one of which I'm going to talk about today. 310 to Yuma, the original 1957 Delma Daves version of it. And a few other things as well. I Married a Witch. I got a copy of that in the Criterion edition, which is a lovely film. The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp. And a bunch of other things, including the original version of The Fly on Blu-ray. It's not a Criterion edition, but it's a movie that I wanted to get a decent copy of, and all I could find were kind of AVI files, but I really wanted to own a copy of it. But I hope everybody did well. I hope everybody is well. And I'll just give you an idea of which movies I'm going to do. I thought I would do another Peter O'Toole, given the fact that I killed him. And so I wanted to go with one that a couple of other podcasters were doing Peter O'Toole movies, which is fair enough. I wanted to kind of slide around what they were doing. And if somebody else has done this, I do apologize. I'm doing The Ruling Class from 1972, a very dark comedy starring Peter O'Toole, Alastair Sim, Michael Bryan, the redoubtable Arthur Lowe, and Carolyn Seymour. So that's going to be a lot of fun. Then, of course, I'm doing 310 to Yuma, one of the classic westerns. If you haven't seen this one, you've definitely got to see it, starring Van Heflin and Glenn Ford. Even though it doesn't have people you kind of know predominantly as western actors, though, of course, Van Heflin was in Shane. I think it's a great character piece, apart from anything else, and based on a story by one of the greats of popular writing, Elmore Leonard. So I'll just get the Mizo open and let you know what I've been watching that I'm not podcasting about. I did indulge my low taste in movies. As you know, I like really upmarket films, but I also like very low-market films. And I saw Machete Kills, starring Danny Trejo, who at the age of 69 seems to be becoming a real pop sensation and a real cult sensation in cinema. And he doesn't have the looks for it. He makes Charles Bronson look like Jude Law. But yeah, I love the fact that somebody like Danny Trejo can have a great career and become incredibly popular and in doing what he does. I believe he's a very nice person in person as well. But Machete Kills, good action film. I think that Carlos Estevez, the guy who plays the president, has got a great career ahead of him in this film. But it's also got people like William Sadler in it, playing a redneck sheriff, Lady Gaga playing an assassin. It's just total balls-to-the-wall crazy. And I really like that. I like movies that just go for it. Apparently the budget was something like $12 million. Robert Rodriguez really is great at making good films on a low budget. He gets really big actors in for a couple of days and then just goes to town with it. And if you're in the mood for that sort of film, it's great. I'm getting it on Blu-ray when it comes out. Auntie Torrent got me the copy that I've watched, but I like it enough that I'm going to buy it on Blu-ray when that becomes available, because it's just too much fun not to. So I saw that. Let me have a look what else. I did see an Italian crime movie, a giallo, no, it's not giallo, but an Italian kind of Euro crime movie called The Italian Collection, La Mala Ordina, which is really cool, and it's very silver and gold, very GGTMC. Stars Henry Silver, Woody Strode, Adolfo Celli, Luciana Paluzzi, and a guy called Mario Adolf. And it's a shipment of heroin goes missing between Italy and New York. Luca Canali, a small-time pimp in Milan, is framed for the theft. Two professional hitmen, Henry Silver and Woody Strode, are dispatched. Now, this, they tell me, is the movie that influenced the two killers played by Samuel L. Jackson and John Travolta in Pulp Fiction. Don't know how true that is, but it's a great little action film. I'm going to have to dip into more of these things. So send me recommendations on Italian Eurocrime movies that you think I might enjoy, because I'm really going to have to get stuck into that more. And I really enjoyed it, even though I really hated it when Henry Silver killed a kitten. So I saw, I saw that, and it was a hell of a lot of fun. Really kind of balls to the wall, late 70s action stuff. And then we have a look. I watched 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, the one with Kirk Douglas and James Mason, Peter Lorre, and things like that. And there's a term called Disneyfication, and I think that even though Kirk Douglas shines through in this, and James Mason shines through, and the special effects were good for their time, I think that there's, I don't know whether it's been lost because I've seen so many things since it, I first saw it or not, but there's a sense of wonder and a sense of magic that's missing from the film. Now, I don't know what it is. Maybe it's my perception. Maybe I don't like Disney. But one way or the other, I think that it really needed to have something else, but I don't know what. A little je ne sais quoi. But apart from that, it was a bit of fun. I always liked watching Kirk Douglas try to sing. And I like the fact that at the start of the film, he walks through the streets of San Francisco with a couple of hookers, one under each arm. I mean, the menage a trois aspect of that is not, did not go past me, if you know what I mean. But I like the fact that it's in a Disney film, the fact that Kirk Douglas was hanging out with a couple of prostitutes in a very suggestive manner. I did watch another thing on Blu-ray, which kind of relates to one of the films that I'm doing today, and that is Shane, the Alan Ladd movie. With, again, Van Heflin, that's the connection there, and Jack Palance in it, and a few other people, Elisha Cook Jr. is in it, Emil Meyer playing the main villain is very good, and yeah, and Brandon DeWild playing the boy in the film. Yeah, it's just a classic Western. It was nice to see such a sharp copy of it too, which I really appreciate. A lot of the things I've seen on VHS back in the day, and seeing a properly sharp copy of it was welcome. I did see a movie which is more GGTMC than it is me, and Big Willie over at The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema mentioned that he'd seen it, so I thought I'd give it a go, and that was The Lords of Salem, the Rob Zombie movie, starring Sherry Moon Zombie, Bruce Davison, Dee Wallace, Meg Foster, Patricia Quinn, Ken Foree. Yeah, it's a really weird film, and I think it's a bit ordinary. The fact that the main actor in it, Sherry Moon Zombie, can't really act. And, yeah, you've got a 40-ish woman in dreadlocks as the main attraction. Yeah, I just think it's for people who maybe took a little too much ice and then were coming down from it and in rehab, and then this is the sort of audience for this movie. Didn't like it that much. Yes, it has nudity in it. Yes, it has nudity from older witches in it as well. Lit very much the same way that Polanski lit the naked witches in his version of Macbeth. But, yeah, Rob Zombie films, maybe I'm outside the demographic for them. Maybe their taste is different than mine. I mean, what he does, he does competently, and a lot of people like it, but it ain't for me, but I gave it a go. And that's always the way to, if you're not sure, watch it, and it, you know, you lose a couple of hours, that's about it. I did see a good film version of a stage play starring our mate Peter O'Toole from episodes like this one and the one before. It's called Jeffrey Bernard is Unwell. It's a stage version it's a play basically that he did in the 1990s. This was filmed in 1999, but he first did it in about 1994, about the English journalist and well-known tosspot Jeffrey Bernard. And it's a Keith Waterhouse play, and it's very good. If you get a chance to see it, and I know that CG, if you know what CG is, has a torrent of it, and it's a good quality one too. Really a superb piece of stage work, and Peter O'Toole at his best, as indeed are a lot of other films and other works. But yeah, I recommend that one as well. Let me have a look here. I decided to go with a couple of big films. I'm not sure why, mostly because I got them really cheaply on Blu-ray. I saw Ben-Hur again on Blu-ray, and it took forever. Now, I've actually met Charlton Heston once and shook his hand at a book signing. And in spite of that, and in spite of everything else, and in spite of how nasty Stephen Boyd's character Masala is, I still want Masala to win the chariot race. I don't know why, maybe because Ben-Hur is such a stick-up-his-ass kind of character that you want the bad guy to win. Of course, the guy playing Pontius Pilate was an Australian, Frank Thring, a well-known theatrical queen of this nation, who went on to have a great career as an eccentric on Australian television after returning from the States. Well, it was returning from Italy because it was made at Cinecittà Studios, but Frank Thring's in it, and we always like to have a bit of Australian. Even, you know, we will watch any movie that has an Australian in it. We'll watch this with Frank Thring in it. We'll watch a movie from the 1950s because Michael Pate's in it, or Victoria Shaw, or Chips Rafferty, or anybody like that who's an Australian. We'll watch it. It's just one of those national things that you do. Let me see what else. I watched with Sal, I Married a Witch, the Renee Clair movie starring Frederick March and Veronica Lake, which inspired any number of other things, including Bewitched. And it was a lot of fun. Funnier than the first couple of times I saw it for some reason, but really a nice comedy, of manners almost. And if you haven't seen, Robert Benchley's in it as well, and Robert Benchley has a nice bit of work in there. Cecil Kellaway's in it. He, too, is an Australian. He plays the father of Veronica Lake's witch and has basically steals chunks of the movie away wholesale from anybody else. He was actually born in South Africa, but he lived in Australia for a long time. But, yeah, it's... if you get a chance to get that one, this is on Criterion, so there's tons of extra material on it as well, which I haven't yet dived into. I recommend that you do that because it's just one of the great comedies of the 1940s. Let's see, I'll find one more thing that I've watched that I can recommend, and you can hear all the clicks from my mouse here. I do apologise if it annoys you. That is not my intention. Let me have a look here. What else have I watched? I've been watching a lot of trailer compilations. You know, kind of B-movie and Grindhouse movie trailer compilations. You can find them on the net very easily. And they're hideously addictive. It's like eating popcorn or peanuts, as long as you don't have a peanut allergy. I've been watching 42nd Street Forever, the five or six volumes of that, which are a lot of fun. And it's always one of those nice things with these Grindhouse movie trailer collections. Yeah, you write down the names of the movies you might be interested in watching, even though you know the trailer will probably give you all the best bits from the film. You want to have a go at it and see them. So I've been doing a little bit of that, and that sucks up a lot of time as well, just watching through the trailer compilation. Some of the different volumes of the 42nd Street Forever do have the same movies in them. But, it's a lot of fun to do if you're a movie buff at all, to just dive into those. But you do have to be aware. It's a bit like playing Xbox games. If you give them an inch, they'll take a mile, and you'll suddenly realize it's Monday morning, you've got to go to work. So trailer compilations are very much like a very immersive computer game in that sense. Anyway, I'm going to take a break now, and when I get back, I'm going to look at, let's do 3:10 to Yuma first. A little bit of black and white widescreen western.
I want to ride again on the 3:10 to Yuma. That's where I saw my love, the girl with the golden hair. Not a word between us was spoken, no, the silence never was broken. But before she left, her eyes said a sad goodbye. Said amore, said amore, to think of the chance that I missed. I could cry, to think of the lips left unkissed. Perhaps she'll ride again on the 3:10 to Yuma, and I can meet my love and tell her how much I care. Though I have no reason to go there, and there's not a soul that I know there, when the 3:10 to Yuma leaves, if I have the fare, I'll be there, I'll be there. Oh,
that, of course, was Frankie Lane singing 3:10 to Yuma. This movie has a Frankie Lane theme song, so you know it's a good one. And this is a classic western. It's not as well known as some of the others, but it really does have a lot of good chops. It's got action, it's a character-based drama, and it has one of the best sociopath antagonists of any western I know of. Now, there's a pretty good praise of the film on IMDb by somebody called Claudio Cavallo. When the charming outlaw Ben Wade, Glenn Ford, is captured after the heist of a stagecoach, the stage line owner Mr. Butterfield, played by Robert Emhart, offers $200 to the men who escort the bandit to the city of contention so they can take the 3:10 train to Yuma so it can be sent on trial. The rancher Dan Evans, played by Van Heflin, is broken, needs the money to save his cattle and support his family, and he accepts the assignment. During their journey, Dan saves the life of Ben when a vigilante tries to execute him. Meanwhile, Ben's gang split off to find where Ben is and then to rescue their boss. When they find Ben is trapped in a hotel room, they put the place under siege and Dan cannot find anyone to help him. Now, the English there is a little broken. I've had to kind of mend it a little bit there, but that's basically it. It's a great character-based Western and a lot of fun. I first saw this on TV, in fact, back in the days when it was all pan and scan, and that didn't really give you the kind of way that the frame worked, particularly during the action scenes. And that's one of the problems with pan and scan is you lose the kind of subtextual information you get from the way that a frame is in a movie. And the shots in this film are fantastically framed. Now, having said that Van Heflin and Glenn Ford are in the movie, there are a couple of strong female roles in this one as well. Leora Dana, an actress who plays Ben Wade's wife, is really good in it too. She's, in a sense, the core of things. She does the same kind of role that Jean Arthur does with Van Heflin in Shane a few years before, but I think she does it maybe even a little better. That kind of woman standing by her man through adversity. Their farm is suffering from drought, their cattle are dying, they're really in dire straits, and the $200 that Mr. Butterfield is about to pay will let them buy water rights for the farm so they can get some water in from elsewhere and water their cattle and maybe save the farm. So everything is at stake over this money, which is why Dan, even though he's a pretty good shot and not without courage, he's reluctant because he's got a family to support, he's got a couple of boys, he's got his wife, he's got the farm. In spite of that, he's willing to go to the danger of taking Ben Wade to the street tent of Yuma so that he needs to, you know, to save everything that he holds dear, in a sense. So there's these conflicting things there. First off, there's the conflict of staying with the family and being safe versus letting their property thrive and not needing to start again. There's the conflict between his wife not wanting him to be in danger and yet knowing that they need the money. And then you've got Ben Wade, the character, played by Glenn Ford, very much playing against type. He's a manipulator, and there's also another strong female character in this film, played by Felicia Farr, a good character actress who was married to Jack Lemmon for a very long time. And Felicia Farr's character, whose name is Emmy, is a kind of former bar girl who's working in a bar in a small town because she got consumption and needed the dry climate, so she moved out there from the city. And her and Ben had a previous history. And he charms her again while he's in town before he's arrested. And just to spend some time, he's a seducer, and he seduces men and women in different ways. Obviously, there's the physical side of seducing the women. But he seduces males into friendship and into manipulating them. And he's a classic sociopath. He's very confident, he's very intelligent, he's very charming, and he's very much out for what he can get. Now, we know right from the start that Ben Wade is a bad prick. Because right at the start, when they're robbing the stage, one of the stagecoach hands holds one of his guys hostage. So Ben Wade shoots them both. So you know he's going to do whatever he needs to do to get what he wants. And that, us knowing that right at the start, then lets us be conflicted when we're drawn into how charming Ben Wade is and how he ends up having dinner with the Evans family and meets the wife and the kids and charms his wife in a way that, of course, Dan Evans doesn't like. And just as he's charmed Emmy, with whom he dallies while he's in town pretending to be a cowhand. Now, there are some other good people in this as well. Henry Jones turns up, a great character actor, playing Alex Potter, the town drunk, who has a very important role to play in the arc of the film as well. What he does and what happens to him is part of the impetus that gives Dan Evans strength to do what he needs to do to get Ben Wade on that train, in spite of the fact that 8 or 10 of his men are scattered around town waiting for him to try to do that. You are one of those guys being Richard Jekyll's character, Charlie Prince. Richard Jekyll, we know, he's in the Dirty Dozen, any number of other films as well. good, strong character actor. But the movie was directed by Delma Daves, who was a writer and director of films for a very long time. He did screenplays for some very interesting films. Hollywood Canteen, I like, a kind of World War II movie. Dark Passage, the Bogart movie, he did the screenplay for that. Jubal, he did the screenplay for that. An Affair to Remember. Youngblood Hawk, Spencer's Mountain, A Summer Place, and all of those. And the movies he directed, he's got 30 credits here. Let's have a look at what we got. And none of them are really top draws. So Broken Arrow, he did that one, which is good. Dark Passage, he directed as well. Hollywood Canteen, he directed. Destination Tokyo, Demetrius and the Gladiator, The Last Wagon, let's have a look. A Summer Place, he directed as well. Wow. Spencer's Mountain, Youngblood Hawk. So there's a number of things there. And, you know, a good jobbing director. He's actually started as a lawyer. And back in silent movie days, he got a job as a prop boy. After he got a law degree at Stanford University, he got a job as a prop boy in the silent era. And then kind of moved up through the ranks from there. So he had a long history in cinema. And this film, I love the way the shots are framed, particularly during the action scenes. They're perfectly done. They're never done in a cliched way, and there's never a kind of, even though the one chunk of the film is in one hotel room upstairs in a saloon, he always finds new angles and new interesting ways to frame the characters, which are consistent with what the dialogue is, which is fantastic, that consistency and that kind of relationship. And it's just one of those things where visually, particularly with the Criterion Edition and the beautiful crisp print that this film has, visually it's a stunning film. Even though it's in black and white, it's lavish in a sense, and you get a sense of the time and place to the heat and the dust and the small town and the countryside. The movie evokes these really well. The way, the kind of, remember when I was talking about the renowned westerns with Randolph Scott? It's got that same kind of feel, but in a black and white movie. And but the core of the thing is the character interplay, but mostly between Ben Wade and Dan. The fact that Ben's much more intelligent than Dan is a threat to, of course, his life, apart from anything else. And the way he's instinctively manipulative of other people is pretty much his superpower. He obviously inspires loyalty in the guys he works with, because they're all risking their lives to come and rescue him. But they've got a kind of plan on that, which is pre-organized too. One of them gets captured. This is their standard procedure. They send out riders to all the different towns around, find out which town the person's being taken to, and get them back. So they're an organized crime gang in a sense in the West, which is an interesting concept, which is never really fully fleshed out, but is an important part of the background of this film. Van Heflin, I always find an interesting actor. He always plays tortured characters really well, and he plays staunch characters well. The last thing I saw him in, which is one of his last roles, was he was the guy that puts the bomb on the plane in the movie Airport with George Kennedy and Dean Martin and all those guys in it. And he plays a tortured soul very well in films. And also he has been a fine character actor. If you have a look through the filmography of Van Heflin, you're going to see any number of classic films. Let me just do that, because I always like having the fun of doing that and just seeing what's in there that I don't know about, which is part of the other parts of the fun there, is finding the stuff you don't know about. And I've gone lateral there and got out a physical book to look this up, which is, of course, one of my Bibles for this podcast, the New Biographical Dictionary of Films by David Thompson. Let's see, Van Heflin. This is what Thompson said about him. Heflin never looked as smooth as a star, and he was not the sort of personality to contain the fantasizing pressure of mass audiences. Unlike many American movie stars, he looked recognizably American. This served him well in his best performances, interesting, unsentimental portraits of Middle America. So that's pretty much him. Thompson goes on to say, he was again good as a farmer in Shane, a blunt, honourable, but not very perceptive man, as ignorant of violence as Alan Ladd is familiar with it. Once more, the sense of family and of pioneering farming enterprise springs from Heflin's rugged plainness. And as the coward in 310 to Yuma, the nerve-shattered reverse of the farmer, harrowed by the task of taking a relaxed Glenn Ford to jail. Now, I don't believe he's a coward. I disagree with Thompson there. He's not a coward. He's just got a whole bunch of different priorities which have to be sorted out. He's not particularly scared of doing all of this stuff. He knows that he's good with a gun, but he's also aware of the fact that he has obligations, and I think that that's the difference there. There is another character, the town drunk, played by Henry Jones in this film, is the person who's maybe the coward, Alex Potter. He's kind of obsequious to people in authority. He's got to prove him. He has a need to prove himself, even though people know he's a drunk, and they kind of accept him as part of their community, but they don't particularly want him on this kind of an enterprise. I think the Henry Jones character of Alex Potter is much more a coward than Dan is in this film. So I'm going to disagree with one of the major movie critics of the 21st century, just because I can. It's a great film. I'm glad the Criterion put this out, because I think the more people know about it, the better. Elmore Leonard's name attached to it doesn't hurt at all. But in general, just to summarise it all, it's a solid character-based Western. And the more I see Westerns, and the more I know about them, the more I come to love the ones that are based on character rather than just action. In fact, I can just stretch that out to any kind of adventure-y kind of movie. Character is at the core of it. If it isn't, you're just messing around. Now, that's why things like the Transformers movies are as shallow as they are. You don't have good characters in them. The whole thing is a spectacle. The whole thing is the smashing buildings down and, you know, vibrators turning into robots and all sorts of shit like that. Character-based action is so rich and rewarding. I really love that. I love the fact that conflict comes out of character and action comes out of the needs of characters. Die Hard being, of course, the example, not the most recent one, which is a piece of shit, but the first Die Hard movie. In any classic action film you know of, where it's just not spectacle, I mean, bullets, different bullets, just basically car chases, and Steve McQueen being cool. I'm just looking at my bookshelf here to try to find the character-based ones. Even a movie like Jaws, the characters are interesting, and a lot of the tension comes from Sheriff Brody being a kind of greenhorn and not knowing, being out of his depth in this kind of thing. So character-based is always the best, and 310 to Yuma is very much that. It's one of those films I'm not going to watch very often, even though I've got it on Blu-ray. I'm not going to watch it very often because I don't want to lose what I get from watching it. So that's about it for that. I'm just going to play another bit of audio from the movie and then take another break. And when I get back, going to be talking about a very, very dark comedy, which Peter O'Toole himself has called it a comedy with tragic relief rather than a tragedy with comic relief. And that is The Ruling Class from 1972.
Hey, Dan, don't make it hard on yourself. All you gotta do is drop that gun on the bed and let me walk out this door.
Wait, listen.
What are you squeezing the watch for?
Are you sure that no one would ever know?
Squeezing that watch ain't gonna stop time. Oh, now. You shouldn't get so scared, Dan. You might make a bad move.
He said there were only a few. I counted seven.
I didn't figure on a big shootout.
Come on, Bill.
There's one of your outfit, Dan. Now, what time is it now? What time do you figure it is, Dan? About 2:40? That's one of your outfit walking out on you, Dan. They'll all walk out on you. Why shouldn't they?
I'll pay you each $50.
Don't you think you have a duty? Do you want to see us shot down?
Please. I'm asking you. Please, I'm begging you.
Look, nobody wants to walk out on you. This whole thing happened in Bisbee. Why should you bring your troubles to contention?
I mean, we've got families. Every man here is a family man.
Dan's a family man, too. I'm a family man. In a way.
Let's get out of here.
You see, Dan, everybody wants to live. And that means Butterfield, too. He'll walk out on you, Dan.
No, he won't. He'll stick, I can tell.
He's human. At 3:05, Butterfield is going to walk out on you, Dan, and he's going to leave you all alone. Now, what do you figure you're going to die for? Huh? Because Butterfield lost his gold shipment? Or because some fool driver got what he deserved?
Which brings us to The Ruling Class, 1972. Directed by Peter Medak from a play by a guy called Peter Barnes. The play was originally debuted in 1968 in the Nottingham Playhouse, and Peter O'Toole bought the rights to the play for £55,000 because he wanted to play the lead character. And a hell of a lead character he is. His name is Jack Arnold Alexander Tancred Gurney, the 14th Earl of Gurney, who is a paranoid schizophrenic. But not only that, but he also believes that he is Jesus Christ.
He can't forget being rejected by his mother and father at the age of 11. They sent him away, alone, into a primitive community of licensed bullies and pederasts.
You mean he went to public school?
Exactly.
I'm the Lord Jesus, come again in my own body to heal the sick, the troubled, and the ignorant. I am he that liveth, and behold, I am alive for everyone. Is everybody happy? Now hear this. I come to proclaim the new dispensation. The gospel dispensation promised only salvation to the soul. The new dispensation gives it to the body as well. Jesus Christ, Mark 1, suffered to redeem the spirit and left the body separated from God. So Satan found a place in man and formed in him a false love, a love of self. Explode! Only feel. Love and sin no more. Most everything you touch, see, and feel glorifies my love. The top hat is my mitre, and the walking stick, my rod. Oh, dear. Oh, once I get started, it's terribly difficult to stop. I'm so sorry.
No, it's fascinating. How do you know your God?
It's simple. When I pray to him, I find I'm talking to myself.
See. Well, how did it happen? How did you come to be in this state of grace?
Like every prophet, I saw visions, heard voices, I ran. But the voices of St. Francis, Socrates, General Gordon, and Timothy O'Leary all told me I was God. It was Sunday, August 25th at 3:32. I heard a terrible thunderclap and saw a body of light like the light from the sun and red as fire. I cried, "Hallelujah, Lord, what will you do?" But the light vanished. Blackness of darkness, until a great brush dipped in light, swept across the sky, and I saw the diversity, distinction, variety, all clearly rolled up into the unity of universal love.
Where did all this happen?
East Acton, outside the public urinal.
This is a very, very dark comedy. Now, that part of it doesn't necessarily illustrate that, but indeed it is. The story basically is that the 13th Earl of Gurney, played by Harry Andrews in a very nice little bit of acting, kills himself by autoerotic asphyxiation while wearing a ballet tutu and rambling insanely. Of course, he is a High Court judge at the time. His butler, Potter, is left a lot of money, and that butler, played by Arthur Lowe, steals chunks of the movie away from Peter O'Toole and the rest of the actors. He reveals himself to be a Russian spy who was infiltrated into Britain and stays in his job, basically taking the piss out of everything he can, being as insulting as possible. But the family, as they need a butler, keep him on. And he kind of acts as a kind of Greek chorus to the action. Unfortunately, after the death of the 13th Earl of Gurney, the 14th Earl of Gurney, Jack, who is insane, inherits everything, and his other family members, his uncles and his cousins, and their wives, decide that they've got to get him committed. They get in a doctor, Dr. Handler, who is played in the film by Michael Bryant, very well, by the way, is brought into... Dr. Herder, his name is not Dr. Handler, Dr. Herder. Comes in to kind of try to cure him or else have him committed as insane. They do try to get him committed as insane, but the Master of Insanity, played by Graham Crowden, the guy who decides whether someone's insane or not, went to the same school as Jack. Therefore, they sing the old school song, and he's declared sane. So they've got to try to cure him in order to manipulate and keep him on the straight and narrow and allow them to continue with their quite lavish lifestyle. Mixed in with all this is Alistair Sim as Bishop Lambton, doing a wonderful turn as a dithery, kind of slightly out of it, not doesn't understand what's going on. Bishop, this is one of his last roles. In fact, his last role was for another movie starring Peter O'Toole in 1977, a TV adaptation of the old Fritz Lang movie Rogue Mail, which stands alone pretty well. It's quite a nice adaptation, a little harder and harsher than the original version. But the supporting cast does threaten to steal the movie away from Peter O'Toole, which is quite an accomplishment. I'm just trying to find the bit. I've got a biography here of Peter O'Toole called, oddly enough, Peter O'Toole, a Biography by Nicholas Wapshot. And here's what O'Toole said at the time about his cast: Alistair Sim, Arthur Lowe, Harry Andrews, Michael Bryan, Coral Brown playing his aunt, and the rest of them. "I've gathered these lunatics just to ruin me," he said. "I stand no chance. First Arthur Lowe steals the seal, then Sim. I'm just the feed. They're all pissing on my grave." And I think he delighted in that as well. I think that one of the things as an actor that he enjoyed was people lifting the game higher. And you can see that if you watch Jeffrey Bernard as Unwell, the stage adaptation, and just seeing how when the other actors hit their marks perfectly and do a nice little bit of business, how O'Toole plays off that and it kind of lifts his energy levels. And this movie is full of that. There's song and dance in it. There's Varsity Drag. There's Arthur Lowe singing music hall songs. There's all sorts of weird and wonderfulness in that first three quarters of the movie. Now, they keep trying to cure Jack. And that's, of course, is where the tragedy comes in. Because they bring in another person who believes he is Jesus Christ. This character being played by Nigel Green. This was the last movie Nigel Green made. It wasn't the last one released, but it was the last movie he made. Unfortunately, his marriage was breaking up, and he overdosed on sleeping pills at the age of 47. Really fine character actor, Nigel Green. You might remember him from the Ipcrest file. He played Hercules in Jason and the Argonauts. He played Carl Peterson in Deadlier Than the Male. And just a really kind of fine character actor who unfortunately died too early at the age of 47. But here's a little bit of him playing the Electric Messiah.
"Who else has electricity streaming from his eyeballs and from his fingers? I'm the High Voltage Messiah."
"The who?"
"The Electric Christ. The AC/DC God."
"But you both can't be God."
"I'm God."
"You are not God! You are what my snotbag's made of!
We are the children of light!"
"The children of light, you know, are far, far away. This is Earthman! One of my earliest failures! Earth is where I dumped the excrement of the universe!
Sometimes God turns his back on his people
and breaks wind and the stench clouds the globe. I am the High Voltage Man."
And it's a nice role for Nigel Green to bow out onto, but this marks the turning point. Jack gets cured, and the cure ends up being worse than the disease. Before the cure, Jack was quite a nice person. He was gentle, he was witty, he was charming. He was a loving husband to the person they set him up with, Caroline Seymour's character, who is the former mistress of Jack's uncle, who is kind of bribed to become his wife, but who also falls in love with him and becomes very much devoted to him. And her name is Grace, and she has some great stuff in there, too. There are some nice bits of acting. She does a striptease with a monologue, which is quite lovely. And also, there are some nice arcs in her character's progress during the film as well. The other good female character in the film is the aunt, played by a Melbourne girl, a local girl from here, Coral Brown, who in later life went on to become Vincent Price's wife. And she had a long struggle with breast cancer, and her and Vincent were married until the end of her life. So, yeah, and apparently she was quite a raunchy and outrageous woman, not adverse to dropping a few F-bombs and C-bombs where it seemed appropriate. And in this film, she's really quite fun playing a kind of arch and knowing woman. She knows that her husband has a mistress. She knows that Jack's being set up with a mistress. And she's kind of somewhat fond of Jack as well, which makes her one of the less nasty characters in the film. Now, as I said, the film does turn and take a very, very dark course. I'm not going to do spoilers on that because I want you to see the film. But I will say that it does end badly for all concerned. And the bottom line of the film is, A, great acting, really weird, non-naturalistic acting. The play itself was kind of bucking the trend of naturalism that the English theatre had in the mid-1960s, and went in for things with outrageous little bits of business and song and dance numbers and all sorts of silliness. But bottom line is, it's a scathing satire of the British class structure and the entrenched privilege and entitlement of the British class structure, and how they can't tolerate anything that's different, and how they destroy what they can't tolerate. But all in all, it's a fantastic film. O'Toole was nominated for a Best Actor Oscar for playing Jack Gurney. He was pipped at the post by another actor, Marlon Brando in The Godfather, who knocked back the Oscar. I think if he'd knocked back the Oscar, they should have given it to Peter O'Toole, who was nominated for an Oscar 7 times as an actor and never won one in his own right. And eventually, when he was getting a little bit old, they gave him one of those honorary Oscars they give to people that it's embarrassing they never gave the Guernsey to. So, yeah, but this one, it's a fine movie. It's, as I said, it's very dark, and it ends on a totally different note than it begins on. But having said that, it's one of those movies that is a bit of a ride. You go, you know, you pay your money, you sit down, you go for the ride, and just let it take you where it takes you. It's very unlike a modern film in a lot of ways. Modern films wouldn't dare do this kind of thing, and it's got a little bit in common with a movie like Tommy, Ken Russell's Tommy, in the fact that the song and dance and the comedy stuff also has a darker edge to it as well. And again, the 1970s were a time when this kind of stuff was done. I think I really like Peter Medak's direction in the film as well. I think that it's one of those things where, and Peter O'Toole called him a mad Hungarian, where this mad Hungarian, who's gone on to have a career well into this century, not a great high career, but a good jobbing director's career, is the person to really carry forth this kind of a film, because it's one of those things where if the tone isn't just right and things aren't done just so, it all falls in a steaming heap. And this movie definitely does not do that. It's it wasn't popular at the time it was made. Maybe the people who were religious were a little more common in those days, and the religious aspects of them pissed them off. But he does a fine job with it, and he's had a fairly good career afterwards. He directed movies like Zorro the Gay Blade and The Craze in 1990. And Let Him Have It, Romeo is Bleeding. And he's done some episodes of TV series like The Wire and Carnival and House. Breaking Bad, he did an episode of Breaking Bad in the second season. And Hannibal, he did the fourth episode of Hannibal as a director. Originally Hungarian, and funnily enough, he was married to Carolyn Seymour as well, so they must have got together at the time of making this film. And then married the opera singer Julia Migenes. He's obviously got an eye for the ladies. And I think he does a great job of the film. It's as long as you go along with the premise, and as long as you follow through. And to be honest with you, O'Toole carries that through. Just the sound of him declaiming these lines, sometimes at a breakneck pace, sometimes slowly, sometimes maniacally, sometimes coldly. The changes that are wrought on Jack Gurney are a real obstacle course for an actor. You've got to kind of go from the gentle crazy to a very ungentle crazy. You've got to go from exaltation to fear to anger to hatred. It's just, there's too many other, it's a Jekyll and Hyde kind of thing, this movie, without giving too much away on the third act. But it's worth it. It really is one of my favourite O'Toole roles, and I've got a few of them. I mean, I like him in Murphy's War. I think he's great in that. I've mentioned Lawrence of Arabia, of course, and what he did with that. You've got The Stuntman. Again, he was nominated for an Oscar for that. You've got My Favourite Year. Any number of things. One of the things about Peter O'Toole is, as I said last time, he never phoned it in. He was always there, and he always added a lot to whatever he was doing. And all credit to him as an actor. And I miss him, even though I may have killed him with my last podcast. I miss the man. I think he was a fantastic actor. He was always over the top, but he was incredibly in control of his instrument. He could hit whichever note the script and the director wanted him to, and he did so. He overcame alcoholism and other problems and went on to be a respected elder in his trade, in his career. And all credit to him for that. This film is really worth your time. I may have to track down the Criterion edition of this, though my coffers are depleted at the moment, and I can't quite stretch to it now. I think it's one of those ones I'm going to have to put on my wish list for future acquisition, because it's really a movie worth having. So I'm going to take a break now. When I get back, I've got some feedback.
Go away, little girl. Go away, little girl. I'm not supposed to be alone with you. I know that your lips are sweet, but our lips must never meet. I belong to someone else, and I must be true. Ah, go away, little girl. Go away, little girl. It's hurting me more each minute that you delay. Please don't say
That was Del Shannon with the creepiest version of a very creepy song, Go Away, Little Girl. If anybody ever wants to make a serial killer movie, I recommend that for the soundtrack of it. It's a freaky version of it. Maybe you can match it up with Bob Lynn's Elusive Butterfly and really have something Tarantino-esque happening there. Onto the feedback. We do have some feedback from far afield. It's from a new friend called John, and John says, "Hi Terry, this is John, possibly your only listener living in the Cayman Islands. I love your podcast, and though I thought I knew a few things about movies, I've learned a lot from your podcast, which I tend to listen to when taking my morning constitutional." What exactly does that word mean? "Of about 9 kilometres, which is just about the right length to listen to one of your diatribes on either older movies or the Martian drive-in stuff. Just one issue. Do you not listen to what you have recorded? On at least 2 occasions, I have listened to inserted sound bites that do not accord in any way with what you said they would be, and indeed, what you said afterwards they were. I'm too lazy to actually go back and quote the particular instances, but the last was a couple of podcasts ago when you said the insert was going to be the director's comments on a movie, and all I heard was a repeat of the trailer for the movie that I played earlier." Okay, I'll stop John's comments there and address that. "I fucked up, John. It was brought to my attention, but I haven't yet had time to go back and amend it. I'm being more careful in future, which is pretty much what I can promise, that I'm going to check all the audios, because sometimes I copy them and paste them, and I go back and load another one, but I forget to copy again, and I paste the old one a second time. I messed up, I'll be honest with you about that, and thanks for bringing it to my attention. I don't mind people doing that. One tiny bit, it'll let me pick up my game, and I will do so. So from now on, I'm going to double-check all inserts and make sure that they are what indeed I say they are." But back to your comments. "In your last Paleo Cinema podcast, you mentioned the 1927 movie Wings. Imagine my surprise when I was browsing Ice Films and saw that Wings was available for download as a Blu-ray rip. Is this just a coincidence? Is it that your comments coincided with the Blu-ray release? Maybe, but whatever the reason, I'm grateful that such classic movies are now generally available, particularly for those of us in the comparatively back end of nowhere, where access to mainstream versions of movies in your preferred hard copy are difficult to find. Anyway, Terry, keep up the good work. Best wishes for you and Sal for Newton Mass, on which subject you might want to check out a book, I think it's called Footprints of God, which starts by interpreting the beginning of the Bible as, 'In the beginning, wisdom created the heavens and the earth.' Don't tune out at this point, I'm not some holy roller, but I thought the concepts which are expanded upon in the book, that the basis of everything is information, is rather compelling, and I think ties in rather well with your Newton Mass philosophy. Shades of the Matrix, perhaps. Anyway, best wishes for whatever holiday season you celebrate. Cheers, John." Thanks, John. It is a coincidence. The Wings Blu-ray came out in Australia. I'm sure somebody would have ripped it and put it up onto the web. It's as good a copy as you're going to get of the film, and I kind of like it. The movie itself is interesting because it's showing the start of making big budget large films. It's just a joy to behold, and it's nice dipping back into very early history of film and seeing the start of special effects being used for well, and knowing a little bit more about how they did certain things. It's just one of those technical side things, the fact that they did teach some of the actors to use aeroplanes, for instance, and had the cameraman sitting in the front of the plane for part of it. It's an incredible endeavor, and it is an important part of film history as well. But to get back onto the idea of God as information, I think I'm not very philosophical about these things. I think that universes, as a physicist once said, are things that just happen now and then. But I do like the idea of passing on information and conveying that and making the world a more complicated and interesting place. I've been having a few discussions on Facebook and the internet in general with people who put up postings saying they're bored. And they've got access to speaking to people across the world by Skype. They've got access to an unlimited amount of information that you could never, ever hope to see all of in a human lifetime. And yet they're bored. They can go out for a walk as long as the weather isn't like it is in Minneapolis at the moment. There are infinite possibilities for amusing yourself in the world as we have created it to this point. And I really think it's silly for people to be bored, and that all relates back to information. Just engorging yourself with information and sharing it and acquiring it and taking selfies and taking pictures of where you are and what you're doing. It's all information, and it all expands the world of the viewer in some way. Even if it's just, hey, the weather over there was like this today. Information is really important, and information is pretty much what we acquire from birth to death. I'm self-educated, and for me that's the name of the game. But anyway, thank you, John. I'm glad you're listening. I'm glad I can make your constitutionals, and no, I don't know why they're called constitutionals, a little bit more tolerable. 9 kilometres is a pretty good run. I did a bike ride the other day of 10 kilometres and another one of 7 or 8 a couple of days before. And yeah, it's not a short walk and a non-trivial task to go on a constitutional. The weather is probably very nice where you are, but either way, I'm glad that I'm a part of it anyway. I did get some more feedback from Tim Levy, but I'm leaving that for the next Martian Drive-In podcast because it relates more to Martian Drive-In than it does to paleo cinema. But we will get there. And anyway, this is about it. Look after yourselves. Enjoy your movies. If you get this before New Year's Eve, Happy New Year. I always like New Year's Eve because I like the idea of renewal in the new year and it being another opportunity to get things right that aren't right and to learn new things and to do new things and to meet new people. Even though it's an arbitrary mark and doesn't really mean anything except to human beings, I think it's a nice time. We're getting just a few people over to our place for New Year's Eve, probably between 2 and 4 people, depending on whether some people show up or not. Very quiet, but we're going to have a few friends over. We might watch a movie or two. We might sit out under the stars in the beautiful, warm, balmy air and just chill out and have a conversation and a few drinks together. So that's going to be my New Year. Anyway, take care of yourselves, and I'll see you on the flip side in 2014. And doesn't that sound futuristic? Later.